BB King Live, just a little love. This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, listener-sponsored non-commercial radio, K22HR Hood River, and K282BH Philomath. Next week will be Lenita Duke and From the Grassroots, but in 2 weeks, a special show with Joan Semperbon and the Stewarts from the local blues scene. This is Tom saying so long. See you in about 3 weeks.
The River Signal.
The River Signal is an original radio story that features music recorded on the Channel Princess Riverboat as it floats down the Mississippi. You can hear the River Signal on 90.7 every week, all summer long.
In their dreams. This is the Mississippi.
On May 16th, listen in for a special broadcast of the first episode on KBOO, live from 6 to 7 p.m. on the deck of the Stern Wheel Riverboat. More information at riversignal.com.
And we're going to that River Signal now, so stay tuned.
The intro is going to say, before a live shipyard audience on KBOO.
Yeah.
Welcome to the River Signal. This is KBOO Portland. We are here on the banks of the Willamette River, north of the St. John's Bridge. Enjoy this performance.
Welcome to the pilot broadcast of the River Signal, a fictional radio serial featuring real live songs and songs. The River Signal is written, recorded, and broadcast from the Channel Princess Riverboat as it floats down the Mississippi.
Except for tonight. Tonight, we're still in Portland, sitting on the bow of the Channel Princess, which is perched atop a huge flatbed trailer in the St. John's Industrial Yard. Just 2 days ago, we pulled the Princess from the Willamette so we could do this live broadcast before a live shipyard audience on KBOO.
Though the River Signal officially starts in June, when the Channel Princess begins its Mississippi voyage, we've written a prologue to set the stage for our weekly episodes and to give ourselves a chance to hone our riverboat radio chops. Again, we're doing this before a live audience from an industrial yard sandwiched between rail tracks and barge traffic. So if you hear a foghorn or mistimed laughter or perhaps a jackhammer, that's why.
All summer long, the River Signal will air on KBOO on Mondays at 7 p.m. The first broadcast, a studio version of this pilot episode, will air on Monday, June 1st.
And now, from the bow of a paddle wheel riverboat, we present the River Signal.
Signal. Prologue, part one.
Now following 10 seconds of silence. When I arrive at the riverbank, it's almost dark. The straps on my pack are eating into my shoulders, and my feet are swollen. I've been walking longer than I ever thought I could, walking for months. I'm amazed I've made it. This must be the source. From all I've heard, the Mississippi gets pretty monstrous in its southern reaches, but here it's just a river, like any other. The kind you'd bet you could throw a stone across, though it would probably fall short. It's quiet. No one around as far as I can see. I take off my shoes and stand in the shallows, and the water soothes my blisters and cuts the stifling heat. As I dip my fingers into the current, a radiation sunset melts the sky into a technicolor smear. Say what you will about the haze, but these sunsets are just awesome. Full spectra of reds and yellows and blues, one after another, sometimes in bands, narrow and then growing. Sometimes flashing like firecrackers, and sometimes throbbing blue to purple. This one goes out strong, a long green stripe that arcs high overhead. Not green like armored jeep or grassy field, but green like green apple, green like a flavor. Every road I've seen is jammed solid with rusting hulks that offer little protection from the sun. When I stopped at the exchange in Gondryville, the keeper told me it's like this all the way to the coast. He told me that's why so many folks are headed for the river. It's the last American highway, he says. The green sunstripe is fading, and my lamp burned out long ago. But downriver, I can just make out what looks like a shed. It seems small, but big enough to lie down in. It's been many nights since I had a good sleep, so I wade from the water, shoulder my pack, and make for the shed. As I approach, the smell of the river gives way to a reek of rusting metal. I lean my pack against the wall, and for a moment, I stand, listening. All is silent but for my breath. I pull my knife from its sheath, shoulder open the door, and step inside. There's a final flicker of light coming through the broken window, bright enough that I can see the shed is empty. No floorboards, just weeds and dirt. Before I take my pack off, I set up the ornament on the ground beside me so it doesn't get broken. The little porcelain monster reaches up to me with red lips and dark mittens. "We're here," I tell him. "We've made it to the river." I take my bag from its stuff sack and lie on top of it, sweating and listening to the electric hum of the crickets and the water bugs. The little ornament is the last thing I have from our old house. Some of the paint is chipped off, but it's the same blue monster of my childhood. I try and picture my family as they might look now wherever they are, but their faces blend with the smiling blue monster, purple noses and big googly eyes. Morning. I realize that I'm not alone. I see the bedroll first, and then a pyramid of dented cans and a sack of rice. Knife in hand, I move my pack and step into the murky dawn light. It's still quiet, the only sound is a rush of river water. But after a moment, I can hear something else coming from upstream. I squat and peer through the bushes. There's a tangle of fallen trees upstream, and north of that, the river bends out of sight. I see no one, but I hear music. Then I see him. He's skirting on the east bank, floating on a homebrewed junk raft, rain barrels and tree trunks, milk jugs and rusty pontoons. He's trailing two fishing lines, one on each side of the boat, and he's playing a banjo. The man is big. Cartoonishly so. He's at least a head taller than me, and that's not counting his hair, which whirls out in every direction, mud-kinked and wild. A red-brown beard covers much of his face and droops down over the banjo strings, which he's plucking with stout fingers. Now he's on the oars, bringing his junk raft around and crossing the river, headed my direction. I doubt he's seen me, but I stay low and take cautious backward steps, keeping brush between us. And then something catches my ankle. I'm up in a second, knife out and pulse racing. I peek over the brush. The big man has dropped to a knee and he sees me. His right hand is gripping what looks like a spear.
I heard the rustling well before the crash. I hoped it might be a steel snake, a squirrel, or perhaps even a weed runner. Something zesty to cook up with all this rice. But no, it's just another walker. I drop my harpoon and stay in a crouch. I've met a lot of walkers, and I know my height frightens them. So I say the least threatening word I know how. Howdy! And I row towards the bank. He stands from behind the bushes, and sure enough, he holds both his fists above his eyes, bows, and steps back. These walkers, they take everything so serious. I play along, as always, raise my hands, do the bow, the steps. I toss him a line, and together we pull the ship to shore. I tell him my name, Reed, and he says he goes by Huckins. Then asks the question walkers always ask, where are you coming from? I tell him I grew up here on the river, but at the moment I'm heading downstream. His eyebrows go up and I can tell he wants to hear more, but I don't want to talk about that. Not right now, so I ask for his story. His eye twitches just a bit and I can tell he doesn't trust me. Other walkers tell me I come off too friendly. They don't believe it. So I tighten my jaw, coil my line. I look downstream and I wait. He relents and tells me he's coming from the west, heading south toward open water in search of family. Heading for the highway, I say? Huckin shakes his head. He doesn't understand. He probably thinks this is the Mississippi. They all do, so I let him down easy. I tell him it's not the big river, just the Crow Wing, a minor tributary. We're close to the confluence, though. While I speak, Huckin stares off into some fuzzy middle distance. Walkers are always doing this, and I can see he's considering how I'll answer the next question he knows I'll ask, so I just ask it. Do you want to come with me? There's plenty of room on the raft. Still staring downstream, he nods and says, that's a kind offer. He gives my raft a look, as if considering its durability, but I know he's thinking something else. That's okay, I'm holding back too. I haven't told him what I'm fishing for. And I'll need some help to haul the big guy in if I ever get a hook on him. And Huckins seems perfect. A hearty fella. I just gotta keep my mouth shut. He's hungry. I can see it in his eyes and his skin tone. He eyes the pieces of salted fish on the raft, and pretty soon he's nodding to himself and then to me. I'll go get my pack, he says.
The current is picking up. Even spitting a bit of froth. This is good. Reed says fish follow froth. For a few hours, we float. Reed tells me how he catches the flies he uses on his rods, and he takes me into coves and behind breakwaters, and shows me the way water swirls over branch cribs that are the best places to toss a line. He shows me his banjo, which is solid metal, pot to peghead. Reed said he used to have a bunch, but he ended up using the wood ones for kindling. Reed seems harmless enough, harpoon and fingernails notwithstanding. Every so often, though, his eyes dart to the water. At first, I think he's just keeping an eye on the fishing line hanging off the back, but it's not that. It's something else. Soon, there's a tug on the line and he pulls in a decent-sized catfish. He's not that excited, but I am, so he shows me how to reset the line. I catch a big pike on the line I set. It's hideous. A mucus-coated snakefish with a nasty underbite. But Reed insists it's good eating. He sets it on the edge of the deck and sweeps away debris, and using a long knife pulled from his belt, he shows me how to fillet the fish. A deft slice behind the gills and then a slow draw from head to tail, blade to the backbone. He flips the fish over and hands me the knife. I try to do the same thing, the gill slice and the backbone trace. But the blade wavers, and by the time I reach the tail, I can see I've left behind several ragged hunks of flesh, and that the fillet is riddled with rib bones. I try and pick them out, but they're too slippery, and even when I do get purchased, they snap in half. I kind of want to pitch this fish back in the river and catch something simpler. Something less bones. Something that's more like a... Reed has dropped to a knee, and his rod is bent like a boomerang. At first, I think he's snagged a log, but the line begins tracking towards the east bank and then abruptly snaps back towards us. Reed is gnawing on his lip and nose breathing in sharp snorts. I ask him what he's got, what's down there, but he raises a hand from the rod and whispers, "It's the carp." And as he does, the line goes slack. I think the fish has slipped a hook, but the creature that emerges from the water is too big to be called a fish. It's longer than our raft and wider than I am tall. And now it's above me. It's jumping 5-6 feet in the air, arcing overhead. Its toothless mouth like a black hole and its slimy gray belly blocking the sun. There's a drenching wall of water, followed by a wave that rocks the boat badly. I nearly fall off, but catch myself on an oar. I try to row the ship away from the devilfish towards shore, but Reed grabs my wrist. He's shaking his head, and he hands me the pole, and then he picks up that harpoon. The pull on the line is incredible. It feels like I'm trying to catch a dump truck. The fish is yanking me this way and that. It's going to snap the line. I know it, and Reed does too. He's got the harpoon up at his shoulder now, and he's tucked low, knees bent. When the fish breaches again, he's ready. The fish is far off, maybe 20 feet. But the moment the harpoon leaves his hand, I know he's aimed well. The spear pierces the fish just behind the gills and the backbone. Reed jumps high and hoots. And I join in, my fear melting to joy as I watch the line spool out. Reed is equal to this challenge. He will bring this fish in, this carp. We will feast tonight and tomorrow night and 100 nights after that. And then after that... The line has gone slack. Reed is crouching, motioning me to do the same. I don't quite understand why, not at first. I hear the water part behind me. It sounds less of a splash than a tear in some great piece of fabric. There's a shadow over the raft as a thunderhead had just slid across the sun. And before I have time to think better, I grab Reed by the shoulders and pull him backwards, off the deck and into the river. When I surface, the first thing I think is, Reed is a terrible swimmer. He's thrashing about, and so I swim over and grab him by the collar and yank him towards shore. Only then do I realize that he's resisting. He's trying to swim back towards the raft. We see it at the same time. The carp, its dorsal fin barely breaching the surface, it's circling back towards us. Reed keeps swimming for the raft, even as I pull his hair, right up until the carp surfaces and opens its gaping mouth and swallows everything. Line and spooler, bags and banjo. My hand strikes sand. I pull myself up onto the bank and spin around to see that Reed has made it too. He's on his back, heaving for air, and I kind of want to kill him. But I'm too spent, so I just stare at the river. The raft is bobbing and dipping in the waves, but the carp is gone, disappeared into the depths with everything I own. I knew I should have stayed on my own. Teaming up with some gung-ho sidekick only works in the paperbacks. Here it's just another way to get into trouble. And now look, no backpack, no tuna fish, no buffalo jerky, no ornament. The jerky had gotten a little bit crumbly, but losing the ornament, I don't want to think about that right now. I decide to tell Reed I'll be moving on, that I do better on my own. But when I go to turn around, something flashes up on the bluff. There's somebody up there, looking down. He's been watching us. He's wearing full flannels and riding the scariest bicycle I've ever seen.
Four weeks on this Rustpox snow bike, and I've seen nobody. I've ridden two tracks and deer trails clear out of Superior Land through miles of unrendered wilderness. I've carried the bike through bramble and forded flooding creeks, bow hunted critters, and made camp under canopy. I even crept into the open a few times when I needed to scrounge up tools to fix this piece of junk. Some bolts, chain oil, a box wrench. And still, after all that, I haven't seen so much as a boot print in the mud. I'm pretty okay with being alone. Have to be where I come from. But I gotta admit, all this quiet, it's been making my head weird. I've been mistaking distant stumps for fellow riders. Been talking to myself even more than usual. Talking to my bike. I've even given him a name, the same one Dad used to call me, Big Guy. He's a good companion, Big Guy. His chain's all shot and pedaling sounds like someone's grinding coffee, and I don't bother using the brakes, the pads wore out a long time ago. But he's a good bike. My only complaint is that he's not much of a talker. And I've been missing that. Talkers. Talking. So when I come up to this riverside bluff, and I see two men fishing from a junk pile raft, my first thought is, finally. I'm about to call out, but then the big hairy one hooks a fish the size of my house and lets it eat half the boat. So my second thought is, maybe I don't miss people. I'm about to step back from the bluff and escape unseen, but the smaller guy looks up and points. They seem pretty harmless, but just in case, I do what I'd read about. I lock my hands behind my head, take a bow. They both just lie there, staring. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. I've never actually tried the Walker Codes. I've only read about them, or heard about them, or heard about someone reading about them. But now the smaller guy, he's raising his fist and stepping back. So I jot a note in my pocketbook about the fists and the steps and that thing with the elbow. And then I shoulder the bike and climb down toward the beach. A few hours later, we're all around a fire, eating sooty fillets from a catfish the big one caught from shore. Reed's his name, apparently. River folk. In many ways, he's what I expected. Ragstock clothes, wild hair, godlike fishing ability. But he's not singing songs or spinning yarns or weaving knee socks from river grass. He's just sitting there, staring at the flame. His friend, Huckins, is silent too. Done eating, poking the fire with a rebar rod. I feel for the guy. He's been walking for months, lugging one bag, and all of a sudden this mutant superfish just eats it? Terrible. This fish is good. Salty and tough. Far better than what I've been eating. Further north, I was gathering berries and mushrooms, bagging grouse and Bigfoot rabbit. I knew that land. But once I got down here, where the haze hit hardest, the game got sparse and the mushrooms started looking like a not real good idea, and I got hungry. That's half the reason I followed that deer trail down here, to catch some fish. And lucky me, I didn't even have to. I still haven't told them why I'm here. I mean, I mentioned Superior Land. I told them I had to get out of that bubble, but I left out the why. I didn't tell them what I'm looking for. Didn't mention the river signal. Not quite sure when I will, or if I will.
Reed is still asleep, snoring next to the fire, but there's no sign of Benson, or the envoy. That's how he introduced himself. It must be some kind of Superior Land thing. Anyways, he's left his snow bike on the grass, and so he can't be far. I'm feeling a little bleary this morning, so I go for a jump in the river. I hear Reed behind me. He's woken up and must be watching me stumble awkwardly through the shallows. Before I dive in, I hear him say something about the fish. Always with the fish. That guy's on a mission. It's murky, but it burns off a little lower, and the brown water turns green like through a beer bottle. I see something reflective on the riverbed, something big. I surface for air, and on the next dive, I go straight for the bottom. It takes me a couple more dives before I put it all together. There's a boat down there. Not a skiff or a junker, but some kind of paddle wheel riverboat. It can't have been down there for long. The paint is still red and the exposed metal still has some shine to it. It's while I'm digging along the sides that I see the little ornament. His gaping red mouth just sticking out above the silt. I pull him free and swim back to the surface, back to shore, feeling rejuvenated. Seems like Reed gave up on watching me flop around in the water. He's now cooking breakfast over the fire, and it looks like he's made up something for me. I'm still not sure if I trust this guy, but I'm glad for the moment that he's here.
Huckins doesn't talk much. He keeps swirling the stewed tomatoes in his mug and twitching his left eye. He's even moodier than the rest. But now he pulls out a sheet of paper upon which he's already drawn a complex system of levers and pulleys. He describes a boat down in the water and a fully formed multi-step plan for bringing it to the surface. It's all very impressive. I tell him it may not be anything to get too excited about. There's probably a whole flotilla of boats down on the river bottom, and a whole flotilla of reasons why no one's bothered to pull them up. Huckins has been at it for a couple hours now. I'm pretty good with ropes, so I help him rig up a webbing that hangs out over the water from one of the docks. When I ask him where he thinks Benson went, he walks over to the snow bike and starts fiddling with the pedals. Within seconds, he's already revising his diagram. Now, in the middle of the page where all the pulley lines converge, there's a picture of Benson's bicycle. It's perfect, he says. It's already geared for this kind of thing. There's no sign of Benson, but I imagine he would be dubious of this plan, especially because Huckins' diagram has some gears and a spool where the wheel used to be. The walker really seems in his element here. He's muttering to himself and he has a spring in his step as he paces around, spinning the bike-driven spool and listening to the labored clicks of the freewheel.
Boot prints. They're fresh. Somebody's been here ransacking this busted old shack. For what, I'm not sure. It can't be the metal. That's all rusted to oblivion, and what wood is left is way too moldy to be any sort of use. Maybe they made off with some salvageable saw blades? Or a halfway decent pulley belt? Or maybe it was just a walker, seeking nothing more than a rough night of sleep. Well, whoever it was, they messed up. They left the one thing worth finding. A radio. It's nothing special, really. Just one of those plastic pocket-sized jobs. Has a belt clip, a built-in antenna, a tiny speaker, and that's about it. But here's the thing. Unlike the dozen other radios I've found in truck cabs and abandoned rucksacks, this thing works. The static is no surprise. It's just like that out here. It's the haze. Smothered most of the signals long before I was born. But not all of them. I spin the dial to the numbers I've memorized, and then I stuff the radio in my breast pocket. I walk, and then jog, and then all-out sprint, headed back toward the beach where I left the others. By the time I reach the cliff, that same spot where I found them fighting their supercarp, I'm gasping for air and giggling like some kind of maniac. I stop, try to catch my breath and compose myself, and that's when I hear the commotion down below. Huckins is down by the water, looking up at all sorts of pulley wheels and lines and waving his arms around. The pulleys are anchored onto a huge dock, and the lines are taut, lashed on one end to what looks like a boat, its bow just poking up from the water. I can't quite see the machinery they're using, but I can hear it. I know that sound. As I lean forward to get a better look, the edge of the bluff breaks away. By the time I stop rolling, my elbow's bleeding, and maybe my face too, and my pants are now torn in four places, but nothing seems broken. So I jump up and I spin around, and sure enough, there's Reed on my bike mashing the cranks. They've stripped off the rear tire, and as I watch the bare wheel strain under the cables, I swear I can see the thing ovalizing. I take off running as fast as I can, which is not very fast because I might have sprained my ankle. And as I hobble, I see the boat emerging from the water, and I hear this ratcheting squeal of overstressed metal. And just as I'm about to tackle Reed off the saddle, the rear triangle of the bike blows clean off the frame. The chain explodes too, and probably the whole drivetrain, I don't know. I can't see. All I can see are Reed's gangly limbs, pinwheeling as he falls from the busted bike. I hear Huckins whooping it up like this is something to celebrate, and I make a mental note to deal with him in a second. And then I'm on Reed, I'm on top of him, trying to get his face up in my armpit, like Dad taught me, when I hear the radio behind me. I roll off of Reed and pull the radio to my ear. I see Huckins running over, and I think he must hear it too. But he just boots the radio from my hand and drives a knee into my shoulder. Now he's trying to wedge an arm under my chin, and I'm trying to tell him it was all a misunderstanding. The bike's not a big deal, but the radio. Huckins pulls his weight off my neck. Reed is holding the radio. For a minute, we all just listen.
They can stay a concrete slab. They can stay in clothes that bind, evaporate.
I stay on my back, smiling up at the sky. I've done it. I've found the river signal, just like she said I would. Now I've just got to figure out how to follow it, how to find her. Yep, here comes the static. Huckins starts fiddling with the dial, like that's the problem, bonehead. While he's distracted, I jump up and swipe the radio and charge into the water. I flip back to the numbers I know, but it crackles, nothing more. I turn the radio off. I look to shore, to my busted bike and the men who busted it, and then turn to that boat lying in the shallows. I was a bit distracted when I first glimpsed it, what with the snowbike melee, but now I'm really taking the thing in and wow. I wade toward it, gaping at those big red paddle wheels on the stern. The bow is nice and wide, and this neat little ladder leads up to an empty top deck. I keep waiting till I'm close enough to see through the portals, and it looks awful cozy in there. Kinda like my cabin. Pinewood siding, wood stove, and some hack job taxidermy still dripping river water. I'm no boat guy, but I've got a good feeling about this thing. Looks like it might run. Might take me down river. Get me closer to wherever she is. I climb from the water, up onto the boat's bow. I've already forgotten about the bike.
Later that afternoon, after we've bailed out all the water, Envoy Benson wires his radio into the boat's questionable electrical circuit. He mounts an antenna up top and fiddles for a bit, and soon he's picking up pink noise across the dial. He seems disappointed. I pass the afternoon pickling the engine and wiping out river muck. The paddle wheels still spin, and I'm betting it'll start up if we can just scavenge a few odds and ends from one of those shacks on shore. Reed tells me he'll go have a look for spark plugs, but when he comes back, all he's got is a 6-foot accelerator rod and some cable. You never know when you might need them, he says. And the next time I look up, he's filing the end of the rod into a pointed hook. Just before sunset, the envoy catches something on his radio. Slivers of voice start coming through, and soon he's dancing on the deck, babbling about full sentences. Reed and I put down what we're doing.
If you've been looking out your windows as I have, you'll notice that the traffic down here's been picking up. People were coming across the plains and sailing by on junk ships and styro barges. If you listen to Dante's show in St. Louis, you'll know it's the same down there. I wish those floaters the best. It's a big river with a lot of room for weirdos. But I wonder if they know what they're getting themselves into. There are things on this river that are weirder than them, weirder than their weird dreams, and weirder than the dreams of those weirdos in their dreams. This is the Mississippi, and the river signal's the only order we've got. And it's not an order like Law and Order. It's like ordering a grilled cheese. Grilled cheese with tomato soup. Just enough to warm you up and put you back on the water with a little more pep.
Hey, Kitty, can we play another?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm doing it again. Of course, we're running out of time. More about grilled cheese next time, because I love grilled cheese. So for now, let's listen to just one more song by Those Willows.
can't believe it. Real voices are coming through. And did she say St. Louis? That's got to be 800 miles from here. I notice that Benson is jotting notes in that little pocketbook. I'm about to ask what he's writing when Reed starts whooping, loud enough that I drop the hex wrench straight into the river. When I spin around, I see he's not looking at us or at the radio. He's got his eyes on the water, and he has that look that tells me I should hold on to something. An instant later, the whole front of the boat hiccups, slammed from below. It's the carp. Somehow, Reed's still on his feet, and that psychotic muckfish pushes up the front of the boat out of the water. He leans with it, his arms swinging out over the bow for balance. He's got his newly fashioned rod harpoon in his left hand, and in the right, the roll of cable, which he's secured to the bow. When did he even do that? I have to admire his technique. It's graceful and measured and totally crazy. Before I can stop him, he's completed his windup, and he drives the harpoon down into some fleshy, gelatinous part of the fish. The next few moments are a blur. Not because I don't remember them, or because I slip and hit my head, which I do, but because in an instant, the cable goes taut, and suddenly we're being dragged downriver by the angriest, ugliest fish I've ever seen. Paddle wheels spin madly, sending up a rooster tail of white water behind us. I look back in the wheelhouse, and I'm almost surprised that I see nobody's piloting this thing. The envoy is in the cabin, but he's just hunched over the radio, cranking the dial. I swing down into the cabin and drag myself behind the helm and spin the wheel. We go sliding across the face of the water, just missing a line of boulders on the east bank. Now the carp jumps and slides across a sandbank, and a moment later, we plow into that bank at full speed. Any fears I have about hull integrity are dispelled. The boat launches off the bank and slams back down into the water on the other side. I'm starting to get a feel for the rudder and steering around these tree trunks and rusty poles. On the bow, Reed is trying to wheel in the cable and fling supporting harpoons at the monster. Benson is still hunched over that radio, scribbling notes, even as the waves pitch him from wall to wall. And as for me, I'm feeling more energy than I've had in months. Feeling like I've just built some new racing cart, and I can take it out and push it all the way and see what it's capable of. This paddle wheeler, it's handling like a champ. And when I think about what I could do, when I'm back on my feet, I can see that the river has become more of a wide delta, and that we're coming up on a forest of big cattails off in the shallows. Benson is saying something about the signal getting stronger, and Reed is shouting, "It's getting tired! It's getting tired!" Which is clearly false. If anything, we're picking up speed. Some crew I've got here. From out of the froth, I can see the carp has a few new harpoons sticking out of it. But it gives less of a mortal wound impression than it does of toothpicks and a club sandwich. It occurs to me that I haven't eaten since breakfast. And then we hit the cattails. The drumbeat of shattering reeds is deafening. The boat's bow is bending up slightly. And though I can tell it was made to take a beating, I'm not sure how much longer it'll hold together. I'm ready for the hull to split open, ready to abandon ship. But now, Reed drops his harpoon. He draws a hatchet from his belt and brings it down hard on the cable, which twangs and disappears into the water. He turns and says, "You owe me one banjo." Before I can say anything, the boat smashes headlong into something hard and huge, sending Reed sprawling across the deck and Benson and I tumbling through the cabin. Benson is wrapped around the wood stove, radio in hand, mumbling, "It stopped. They stopped playing." I kneel beside him, trying to figure out what he's even talking about. But then I hear Reed shouting from the deck. Benson and I climb out of the cabin through a settling cloud of pollen, and I see what we ran into. It's a bobbing mass of shining metal, an old trailer floating on two plastic jug stringers. Apart from a deep dent where a riverboat hit it, It's almost spotless. I can see all of us reflected off the trailer's polished metal sides, like a carnival funhouse mirror. We're gaping, distorted, and stretched out. I've never been one for the phrase, larger than life. It doesn't make much sense to me, and it implies that life has fixed borders or edges of reality or reason beyond which there's nothing. Maybe I once thought of my life like that, like a terrarium with glass walls, full of animals and plants, some dangerous and some nutritious. Somewhere where all you had to do was survive all the known dangers, outrun or outwit everything else in the tank. But now, I don't know. Now, reflected from the polished trailer, that's how we look. Larger than life. Benson's beside me, holding up the radio.
Ugh, I think someone just hit us. Really? Again? I swear, if that's another band of styro bargers, I'm gonna pull their hair out and make them eat it. Without dressing.
Geez, if you guys wanted an autograph, you could have just asked. Well, come on in. It seems like you've got a lot to learn about the river signal.
This episode was made possible by Kitty Rocket, Joel Shupak, Mark Fisher, Matt Stein, Sarah Golden, Sam Mowry, D. Neil Blake, Ron Spurgeon, Those Willows, Matt Fravor, Nation Slingman, Scott Sutton, Jim Petzold, Shani Aviram, Brian Huckins, and Avodica, Dan Benson, and all 104 of our Indiegogo backers, Green Anchors, Ear Trumpet Labs, and KBOO 90.7.
Beginning in June, you can tune in to The River Signal every Monday at 7 p.m. on KBOO 90.7. To learn more about the project, check out riversignal.com.
And now we'll pass the mic over to tonight's guests, Those Willows. They'll be rounding out the hour with some more great music. Thanks for listening to The River Signal.
So green. keep going.
Cold day ketchup. Do you ready for that, Jules? Thank you.
What's a day but a night asleep? What's it like wondering? Love fast, loud at end of the night. I'll be over there in a little. color I always imagine.
Is this mic on? Yes, it is. Well, thank you guys so much for coming out. This is the end of our live broadcast, but you can tune in throughout the summer on 90.7 and at our website, which is riversignal.com. Thanks again so much for coming out and for listening. Have a good night.
This is KBOO Portland. That was the River Signal, and up next evening of Afrotainment. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. We thank you.